Good morning, everyone. I call this meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs to order. It is now 8:05 a.m., Tuesday, March 14th, 2023, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Vice Chair Representative McCabe, Representative McKay, Representative Himshute, Representative Mears, and myself, Representative McCormick, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this opportunity to silence your cell phones or any other noise-making devices for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, I would like to thank Linda Jensen, the House Community and Regional Affairs Secretary from Records, and Kelsey Riker from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Today we will be hearing an appointee to the RCA board and introduction on bills HB 78 and HB 30. First up is Robert Doyle for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Second, we will hear HB 78, which is a bill that I am putting forward regarding Community Health Aid Appreciation Day. And then thirdly, HB 30 by Representative Ortiz is to observe daylight saving time all year. Please let the record reflect we were joined at 8:06 a.m. by Representative Ruffridge. Is there anything from the committee before we get started? No. Okay. Well, I believe we have Mr. Doyle on the phone. Mr. Doyle is joining us via teleconference today. Mr. Doyle, if you're there, you please put yourself on the record, and you may begin.
Well, through the chair, my name is Robert Doyle. I've been appointed by Governor Dunleavy as the commissioner, as one of five commissioners to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and I accepted this opportunity for community service. I came out of retirement to do so. I'd like to thank you all for your consideration and appreciate any support, and I'm ready to answer any questions that you may have. I'll try and be brief and to the point.
Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Doyle, Representative Mears?
Yes, Mr. Doyle, if you could just, since you mentioned brevity through the chair, could you please give us a brief synopsis of your background for this work?
Yes, through the chair, yes, I can. I've spent 31 years in public schools in Alaska, the last 5 years as superintendent of Matanuska School District. After my retirement, I served on the Matanuska Electric Board of Directors for 12 years. Several of those years as Secretary Treasurer, and the last 2 years as the chairperson for the board of directors there. So I believe even in my time when I was working in the Matsu School District, I worked a lot on energy issues, energy conservation, and trying to, as one of the largest, if not the largest, consumer of electricity in the Matsu Valley, to do whatever we could to make sure that that was done in a safe, reliable, and affordable way so that we could spend more money on the children's education. So that, in a nutshell, that's my resume.
Thank you, through the chair. I really appreciate your background on a utility board. It's a lot of folks spending time on utility boards don't get a lot of credit for doing that, and I appreciate you bringing that expertise. Thank you.
Are there any other questions from the committee for Mr. Doyle? Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Doyle, I'm interested to know your opinion on the renewable direction with the electric utilities that Golden Valley and MEA are taking, and how you might further or block that agenda.
Through the chair, that's an excellent question, and the time that I was serving on the Matanuska Electric Board is the time that we started the solar power project, 1 megawatt out in Willow. Additionally, we facilitated the independent power producer that was going to do one out at Point McKenzie out around Houston. And I believe that was going to be 9 to 10. It was going to be the largest solar power project there. I think that the key to this is the connectivity, trying to make sure that as these independent power producers and as the utilities move in the direction of renewable power, including power from Bradley Lake and hydropower, running river power, et cetera, that it's brought into the system. It can be done in a reliable way. A lot of it's variable, so we have to make sure that the base power is backing that up. And at the same time that, you know, we can have some battery storage to offset that when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine. And I think that one of the key things that I'm real proud of in terms of the time when working with MEA was SB 180-123, I believe it was, where we got the first ERO authorized by the legislature, and in the little bit of time that I worked here at the RCA for the last, I think, 8 or 9 months, we actually brought that to fruition where the ERO is now stood up. It has a budget and can start working on these projects for renewable projects that are, again, like I said, reliable, affordable, and safe. So that would be my position on those things.
Follow up.
Thanks, Mr. Doyle. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the commitment to sustainable energy. I'm curious, maybe it's a bit of the wrong direction, but do you think that the wind turbines in the northern Mat-Su or Denali borough actually will be able to compensate for the shutdown of Golden Valley or Healy 2?
Through the chair, that's the plan that GVA has, and I think also we have Chugach, which is working hard at trying to take a look at wind power in a pretty big way, as well as solar. And I think we need to make sure that we give all of those opportunities and we use that renewable power on a sustainable basis. But at the same time, I think in the short term, we need to make sure that for energy security purposes, that we have the natural gas and the generation that we have at MEA and in Chugach that can help, because I know that GVA is counting on a chunk of that natural gas and that power to be transferred up on the intertie. So we also need to make sure that our transmission lines are open to that and can handle that, those loads as we move them from one place to another. And that one of the things along those lines is I've been very supportive of a tight pool where we can dispatch power from whatever the cheapest generating source is and move it to where it's where the needs are. So I think in the future we have a small tight pool between Chugach and MEA. I would hope that we can open that tight pool up and include it to all areas of the intertie from Fairbanks all the way down to the Kenai. So that would be my thoughts on that.
Follow up.
So one final question on the electrical, because this is something that I think many of us are pretty interested in. So we know you mentioned intertie. We all know, I think, that it's not really an intertie. It's an extension cord that goes from Homer to Fairbanks. An intertie would assume that there's more than one extension cord, if you will. So I wonder if you, through the regulatory commission, if you would support, I think it was a $1.2 billion, and that's probably a political question, but increase in electrical lines. Our extension cord is 50 years old, so I'm wondering about your thoughts on a new intertie or a new power line between South Central and Fairbanks. And also, you know, there's another thought about nuclear power the small the suitcase nukes, if you will, or the Connex nukes. I'm wondering if that's something that the Regulatory Commission and you would or you would support.
Through the chair, I think that I think we basically have to look at all sources of power. I think we had to have everybody come to the table and get all of the facts out that we can. I think the ratepayers expect that. I don't think they expect anything less. They expect to have the not just their pilot lights on their heat, their boilers to fire up when they need it, but they also want it when they turn that switch on that the power runs. So I support fully the development of a good backbone. It's not just an extension cord, but you also have to look at our gas supply. I mean, it's one gas line. We need to make sure that we have redundancy in the system, and that's why I really emphasize reliability. I think that the public expects us to keep the lights on and the power going, and I think that we're going to have to do whatever we can to unconstrain Bradley so that there's an easier way to get that power off, and as we boost up the hydro resources on Bradley Lake, that we can get all that off of the peninsula and all the way up to Fairbanks so that you know, I know that when I talked to GVA, the power out of Bradley Lake is some of the cheapest power they have, and they don't want to lose any of that. Matter of fact, they'd like to use as much as possible. So I would think that the micronuclear, I think that unconstraining power and having a redundant system to where if there's a problem with one power line, that we've got a second one to back it up are all good things. The funding of that and the policy issues behind it, I think, are something for the legislative delegations to make final decisions on, and then the RCA will carry it out as we carry out the statutes that are given to us. And that's my thoughts on that.
Thanks, Mr. Doyle. I appreciate it. You guys and the four guys that you work with are the unsung heroes in the background in our state when it comes to electrical and that sort of thing. So I appreciate your thoughts on that.
Any further questions? Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Doyle. What are some of the issues facing the RCA right now? If you could just describe a couple of the big things that you're working on.
Through the chair, I can't talk about open dockets specifically, but I do think that one of the big concerns is energy security, and it's not just in the South Central rail belt situation, but I think throughout the state. I think the price of diesel this year and is incredibly difficult. I know that the legislature last year changed and increased the PCE to a certain extent, but I also think that we need to continually stay focused on small rural village cooperatives and other, whether they're investor-owned or cooperatives or munis. I think we need to take a look at those and make sure that they're operating as efficiently as possible, keeping the rate as low as possible for folks. I get real concerned when I hear about, you know, school closures because of power outages. I get real concerned when I hear about senior citizens that are having to go without lights and unable to get their generator going, even if they have a transfer switch. I get concerned when I hear people having to bring river water and garbage buckets because the water at the washateria is not working. So I think that there's big issues. Those are the ones that I'm concerned with personally. On my whiteboard in my office, I say, is it good for all ratepayers? And I do mean all ratepayers, all Alaskans, no matter whether they live, wherever their zip code is. So I think that energy security is probably foremost on my mind, and I think rightly so. So that would be my main focus. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Doyle? Okay, seeing none. He's the last chance. No one? Okay. The House Community and Regional Affairs Committee has reviewed the qualifications. Well, excuse me. First, let me slow down. I apologize. Thank you very much for meeting with us this morning, Mr. Doyle, and taking our questions. Seeing The House Community and Regional Affairs has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to the joint session for consideration, and that name is Robert Doyle, the nominee for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. This does not reflect any intention of any member of this committee to vote for or against the individual during any further session for the purpose of confirmation. Thank you again, Mr. Doyle, for your time this morning. We will now take a brief at ease to transition to the next item on the agenda. All right, we are now back on the record. Would Callan Sifluk Sifsoff, staff to myself, please come forward, put yourself on the record, and introduce our legislation this morning.
Hello, thank you, through the chair. Thank you for having me today. My name is Callan Trifluk Sifsoff, and I will be presenting regarding HB 78, the Community Health Aid Bill. And I just want to begin by thanking everybody for having me. My mom was actually a health aide throughout my childhood, and I come from the Bristol Bay region, a town called Aleknagik. And in that community, just like hundreds of communities around the state, community health aides are truly the sole and only form of emergency medicine, and their roles are very extensive, not only do they provide emergency care and regular standard medical care, but they also coordinate with doctors and nurses that travel out to villages. So the role of community health aides can't be overstated, truly. The community health aid program is very unique to the state and was established out of necessity for many of the communities across the state. As you all know, they live in remote areas, and so the role is actually very complex and requires oftentimes community health aides are on call at all hours of the day, pretty much. And then, as I stated before, community health aides are critical to coordination for doctors and nurses and travel into rural villages. Oftentimes they have relationships with community members and the trust of local people to provide emergency care is very unique and special for Alaska as well. There's a complex history for community health aides beginning in the 1950s during the tuberculosis epidemic. That's where the profession began out of necessity to ensure that medication and during that epidemic medical care was received for communities all over the state. As you can see, there's a number of different timelines where the CHAP program has formed, and September 10th was the first planning and advisory committee meeting for health aides in Alaska. So for that reason, that's why we'd like to establish September 10th as Community Health Aid Appreciation Day. And then just to note, also the role of health aides has actually evolved to include dental health aides as well as behavioral health aides, which are very critical as well. In addition to just standard medical care, really they are first responders in all villages of Alaska, and they work really hard. And the training is extensive and also requires them to be an upper echelon of professionalism in order to serve their role, really. As you can see that there are training centers for community health aides in Bethel, Nome, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. And the numbers are extensive, hundreds and hundreds of community health aides across the state. It's again a unique role because a lot of times community health aides are a critical role in the community for trust of the medical care system all over Alaska. Oftentimes with ANMC, health aides are the first people that communicate if there's more advanced surgery that needs to happen or a trip to Anchorage for additional medical care. So community health aides are the trust for a lot of Alaska for the medical care system. And as you can see, this, as we all know, our state is huge. And so, again, health aides are community members, and the job that they do every day is a huge role. Throughout COVID-19, health aides were critical for all of Alaska. When I say critical, it just can't be overstated. Health aides are the sole way that people access medical care for most of Alaska. And it's really, really important. As you guys can see the slide there, I actually personally know over half of the people in that photo, and the smiling faces of these health aides, it's not just medical care, it's a very critical role for most of Alaska. So thank you guys.
Thank you very much for presenting on our bill this morning. I really appreciate it. Are there any questions for Ms. Trifluk-Sisoff this morning before moving into testimony? Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you, and through the chair, could you maybe, just to get it on the record, give us a little bit of an idea of what the training involves? I'm really interested in this.
Yeah.
And, I think another of our unsung heroes probably in villages. And so it'd be interesting to get on the record what kind of training they go through.
Yeah. Through the chair, thank you for the question. And the CHAT program, the training is fairly extensive. Typically, health aides, they start their role in the village, and then before they start actually working as a health aide, they've gone through weeks and weeks of training in Anchorage, typically, or in Bethel, Nome, or Fairbanks. And those are the four hubs for the CHAT program training. So at ANMC, for example, health aides will spend weeks, pretty extensive. I mean, if you can imagine the breadth of what they see, from critical life-threatening illness, emergency medicine. So they get quite a big, broad purview of what the role is, and for weeks in Anchorage.
Follow up.
Thanks. And so, pay. Do they get paid for doing this, and is it paid by the village or?
The role of health aides, it depends on each community. But for example, for where I'm from, Aleutianik, Alaska, the Native Corporation or the BBNA is the funder of our health aid program. Health aides are often on call 24 hours a day, often not paid for the work that they're on call for and responding. So it's definitely a labor of love, and the people in those villages that take up this work, as you can imagine, you're always working. So it really is people's motivation morally to be a health aide typically. And the pay I think it's typical that they're not paid for on-call work. Yeah.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Any additional questions? Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. So I had the great privilege to work for Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium early on in my career, doing sanitation infrastructure, and clinics was a part of the work that we did. So I had the advantage of getting to see, firsthand the facilities that folks were working in and the care that's provided to communities. So I mostly just wanted to say thank you, team, for bringing this forward, and absolutely supportive. So thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, I would echo Representative Mears. Thank you for bringing this forward. Just a couple of questions on, I guess, this position in general. From your description, and I've gotten the pleasure of knowing a few health aides, could you describe what a day looks like for a health aide in their position? I know you're talking about on call and things of that nature, but what are the services that they're providing on a regular basis? What are they trained to do? We saw some slides of vaccines and other things, but it sounds like they're a jack of all trades. So maybe describe that a little bit.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. I think I'd like to defer. I'll speak a little bit to my personal knowledge through my mom's work as a health aide, but I'll defer that question to the testifiers that we have online. But personally, you know, when my mom was a health aide through my childhood, she worked really closely with the VPSO in our village. So it was really the health aide and the VPSO that were pretty much responsible for all crises. So it's obviously health aides definitely provide daily medical attention for people, but they also are a critical part of the law and order in the community and are often first responders alongside the village safety patrol officers and coordinate pretty much daily with everything that comes up. So oftentimes there are clinics. Sometimes there are no clinics in villages, and health aides are required to go kind of house to house. And really everything from, you know, elderly ear cleanings to trauma, massive trauma all over the state. So, yeah, and it really does vary from village to village how much or little the health aides have to go out into the community as opposed to being in a clinic. So.
Thank you.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, I also wanted to comment. It seems like we're all touched in some way by these amazing mm-hmm. people. My mom was a trainer of village health aid. She was an RN out at YKHC, so years and years and years ago. My question is, are health aides mandatory reporters? Mm-hmm. So in terms of OCS and I'm not sure. It doesn't really matter, but I was just curious.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. Actually, we have a few people from the CHAP program, the Community Health Aid Program, and they would definitely be able to answer that. I'm not exactly sure. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much again. I'm sure a lot of our testifiers will be able to add some more details to some of your questions as well. So moving on, I think we'll hear first from our invited testifier, Jessica Hyatt. She's with Guardian Flight Alaska. Ms. Hyatt, if you could state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Jessica Hyatt, and as mentioned, I work for Guardian Flight Alaska. I'm a community relations advocate for the company here in the state. And, you know, wanted to testify on behalf of Alaska Community Health Aid because we at Guardian Flight Alaska work shoulder to shoulder with community health aides on a daily basis. So, you know, Alaska has pioneered the community health aid program, and we have the fortunate position at Guardian Flight to have, you know, worked in the rural villages and with community health aides for the last 30 plus years. The work of Alaska Community Health Aides is tireless. They act round the clock first responders. They're clinicians. They're at times our first point of contact, being medevac, travel coordinators, hospitalists, tribal liaisons, and are often related to or close to their patients. So a lot of what Callan has kind of spoken to. Guardian Flight has worked daily with CHAP trainers and tribal health organizations. And especially we saw through COVID that health aides cared for their communities with such compassion and really never ceased to support their communities. And that just speaks to the fact, you know, Callan said a lot of the time these villages don't have clinics, but even during COVID when the clinic was present, that health aides were going out to houses, you know, in full PPE to do COVID checks and to check on community members and really never ceased on serving. So we recognize the commitment that community health aides make to care for their communities and also those who enter it. And sometimes health aides have shifts that last 4 to 6 weeks. So you can imagine that if you're the single school provider for a community for that long, you have to definitely have a heart for caring for people. You know, we recognize like September 10th being said is a significant in Alaska community health aid history. That being said, what Callan had said, planning it was the first planning and advisory meeting for the CHAP program. And one of the biggest things for us that we recognize being a private entity here in the state of Alaska, but also part of a global network down in the lower 48 is that states across the nation are adopting the Alaska model as their own method for tribal healthcare solutions. And the timing of the bill definitely honors the nation's original health aides for their millennia, protecting and ensuring the good health of their communities. So it could not be better, giving recognition where recognition is due.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Hyatt. Does anyone have any questions? I'm not seeing any now, but if you could just stay on the line, we might have some come up that you might be able to speak to later. So thank you very much for your testimony this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Up next, we will hear from Carolyn Craig of from ANTHC. Ms. Craig, if you could state your name for the record, you can go ahead and begin your testimony.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair McCormick, members of the House Committee on Regional Affairs. My name is Carolyn Craig. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, a PA, and the director of Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Community Health Aid Program. I've been a part of CHAP for over 40 years, starting as a health aide for 15 years in the Upper Kuskokwim region, the villages of McGrath and Jacotna. And I had the honor of working with my mother-in-law, Rose Winkleman, who was in the first graduating class to be federally recognized with congressional funding in 1968. So the Community Health Aid Program, as you've already heard, is unique, it's amazing, and it's proven effective at providing culturally competent and quality health care for remote and underserved areas throughout Alaska. Health aides provide care to their family, their friends, and the people that aren't so friendly to them, which they do with professionalism and minimal training. Community Health Aid Program is part of the Alaska Tribal Health System and is the front line of health care for the system. There's 180 village health clinics throughout Alaska with 550 health aides, 25 sub-regional clinics, 6 accredited regional hospitals, and an ANMC as a tertiary care hospital. Within this framework, the health aides are the basis for all referrals and the start of care in rural Alaska. Health aides are locally hired by their tribal health organization. They know their patients, they know the area, they know life events that are influencing their patients, and it's proven an effective model because they are caring for their people and all the things that factor into better patient care, interaction, trust, and being culturally competent in quality health care. They work under the supervision of a physician in their region, and they use the CHAM, which is the Community Health Aid Manual, for every patient encounter. So that is their cookbook. For every patient they see, they will follow it from start to finish. They care, they're trained, 15 weeks is the total training. It's separated into 4 sessions of 3 to 4 weeks. Then they will go home and they will see patients, put in a couple hundred hours of clinical time before coming back for the next training session. They're trained in a combination of primary care and emergency medicine, but they see all patients, and not all of them are in the clinic. They respond to multiple calls outside the clinic by snow machine, four-wheelers, boats, private planes, miles out of town many times. So if you could imagine anybody that has a medical background, or even if you just know somebody, a physician that would be dropped off in a remote village. No crash cart, no emergency medicines, spotty internet. Maybe they've had, you know, 15 weeks of training somewhere, and they have a book to guide them on everything to do. Most people would run from that, and the health aides deal with that every single day. They respond to heart attacks, severed arteries, gunshot wounds, suicide. They deliver babies 15 miles away from the clinic, up a river in the middle of the night. I could go on and on about stories that you hear every day through your health aides, and they're never publicized. They're just what they do. They get stopped in the stores for questions. People call them at home after hours. Being a health aide is 24/7, no matter what you hear. It isn't, you know, a 9-to-5 job at the clinic and you go home. It's constant and always there. And all of this, like I said, 15 weeks of training and a manual to guide you through every patient encounter. I can't say enough about how amazing it is. ANTHC has recently, starting in 2015, started a distance learning program for basic training. This has allowed students to complete portions of the training at home and minimize their time away, and it's proven very popular with our students. So, CHAP is a program that's worked for 55 years now. It's gained national and international interest. The expansion of the program is currently being worked on and discussed between IHS and tribes in the states. And there is a lot of interaction with Alaska for our best practices to help make program success in the states. And I could go on and on about the program. It's near and dear to my heart. It's absolutely amazing program. There's not enough good that could be said about the health aides throughout our state. So I thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Ms. Craig. Are there any comments or questions from the committee? Hearing none, Ms. Craig, if you could just please stay on the line. Haven't had any questions yet, but we might have some come up. So if you could just stay on the line until we're done here, that would be greatly appreciated if any questions do come up. But thank you very much for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Next, we will hear from Ms. Jenny Brown of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Ms. Brown, if you could state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Jenny Brown. Thank you for hearing my testimony this morning. I thought Carol and Craig did a wonderful job of kind of summarizing the high points of what health aides do, so I'm going to focus more on kind of my experience from the outside and the inside. I'm a paramedic by training. I have been an EMS and clinical educator in Alaska for the last 25 years, including helping to open the Health Aid Training Center in Fairbanks. During this time, I've worked with many rural medical providers in the interior and around Alaska. And while all our rural providers are under-resourced compared to most other parts of the state, the ones that have gained my most respect are the community health aides. Their situation varies greatly from region to region, as was already mentioned. But the underlying theme is they provide the essential medical care to our village residents. Without any advanced degrees, they not only help to manage the day-to-day medical needs of their community, but they're also often the only emergency medically trained people in their village. As we know, emergency medical care anywhere can be stressful and incredibly emotional. But again, we need to recognize these patients are also the community health aides, family members, and friends, making these experiences even more challenging. During my 11 years with Tanana Chiefs Conference, I've had many doctors, PAs, and nurse practitioners share with me their anxiety about doing village travel because they worry about having to care for someone in an emergency or care for a patient for long periods of time if there's delays in medevac transport. This experience is the daily reality of our community health aides. Their dedication, motivation, and bravery needs to be recognized on a regular basis, and I'm encouraging you to establish an annual Community Health Aid Recognition Day. So we're reminded at least once a year to think about and acknowledge these amazing healthcare providers. I'm open to any detailed questions that you would like to ask, and I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Brown. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? Okay. Well, thank you very much again, Ms. Brown. If you could just stay on the line for any questions or comments that might come up.
Thank you.
Next, and I believe our last testifier for this morning, someone I've had the privilege of working with back in Bethel. We've traveled to a few villages together. Very pleased to invite Ms. Acela Calhoun to speak with us this morning. Ms. Calhoun, if you could state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, good morning, and thank you, Representative McCormick. And it's an honor to be here, and members of this committee, thank you for the invitation and opportunity to testify at this hearing. My name is Acela Calhoun. I'm the director of the CHAP Programs in Education at the Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation. I've been here for 7 years. My first exposure to the health aides came when I arrived in Bethel, and I absolutely fell in love with not only the program, but what the health aides do. I know many of them personally, visit the villages regularly, and know the tremendous amount of work that they do and how well they do it. With that being said, let me just give you an overview of the communities we serve. At YKAC, we serve 58 communities that are all part of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. 48 of those villages have clinics within them in the community, and 5 of them are sub-regionals, which are slightly larger, and 42 are village clinics. I believe that it is really fitting that community health aides be recognized as the pillars of healthcare in remote Alaska. By way of a brief history, and you heard a little bit of this already, the concept of CHAs as healthcare providers in their home villages developed and morphed over a period of more than 50 years. Beginning in the 1950s to help stamp out the TB epidemic, it became evident very quickly that health aides could bridge the gap in access to care for remote and isolated indigenous communities throughout Alaska. So in 1968, the program was recognized and federally funded by the U.S. Congress in 1968. In 1969, YKAC opened the first CHA training program. Subsequently, other training centers were opened throughout Alaska, and a statewide curriculum was developed in partnership with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. UAF. The CHA basic training curriculum was standardized and the CHA manual completed. After that, in the 1990s, as the program developed more and more and more skills were added to the program, the 1990s became the going years. With the 1994 Alaska Tribal Health Compact, the opportunities expanded for tribal health organizations throughout the state to establish the program even more. And in addition to that, the certification board and standards and procedures were also completed and established. So now moving forward towards where we are today in 2023, I'm delighted that you're considering this bill. CHA program in Alaska has become not only unique and have been unique to Alaska and still is, even though it will eventually expand. It is rich in culture and community. The stories, as Carolyn began to speak about very well, are many and too many to mention in a meeting like this. But they provide quality care and consistent provision of care through close to home for our remote community. It has become the model to imitate, as you just heard. As other programs develop in the lower 48 in the future, we will see that grow even more. So community health aides provide routine and acute medical care, preventative care, including immunizations, well-child checks, patient education, prenatal visits, community health events, such as mass flu clinics, and they respond to emergencies day in and day out, and they often save many lives. And as Carolyn said, they deliver babies as well. They rotate after hours and weekend on-call response, sometimes for very long periods, especially during inclement weather. I have often seen them waiting for medevacs for 2 or 3 days because of the weather, keeping a very ill or injured patient stable until the transport to a higher level of care is available. So CHH faces challenges, in my observation, with grace and resiliency out of a high professional ethic and love for their communities. And just to give you an illustration, in one of our recent surveys to CHAs in our region, a sentiment analysis was done, and in that it was described the value that is ascribed to being a community health aid in this area. And it was described as a very personal and deeply held tradition for the community. Some of the key words reflected and described the value that was given by the health aides themselves to the history of the community health aid program in Alaska. And the very personal impact of this profession to them, their villages, and the people of the Yukon Delta. Some words or phrases that were repeated often included, and I quote one, I am able to help my community, to help the village community be healthier, and educate the community about health matters. Multiple comments also eloquently expressed how being a health aide became a generation or a generational thing for in families. And I quote, I became a health aide because my mother was a health aide. And that was repeated multiple times. Also important was the element of pride and respect that is gained by the individual that serves their village and people in this role. So, for example, in 2022, AFN recognized another daughter, Jean, of CHB, who served at the village in Nicoria. They were recognized for immunizing 98% of the village population against COVID-19 within a short period of time after the vaccine was released and approved for use. That was an amazing feat. And they accomplished it because they love their community. So I will close with a very compelling illustration. If any one of us found ourselves or our families in a very remote area, miles from the nearest hospital facility, suddenly faced with illness or unexpected injury, it would be comforting to know that our next-door neighbor is a qualified, trained healthcare provider who can assist, stabilize, or even save our life, while truly caring for us personally. The health they serve, their families, their communities, their friends from childhood, so they are very connected to the people they serve. And, of course, this is a fitting description of what the community health they does, day in and day out for their community. CHAPSA, without a doubt, in my opinion, the heart of care in the remote villages of the Waikiki Delta in all of Alaska, and we lend a wholehearted support for the HB 78 Act established on September 10th of the Community Health Aid Appreciation Day. Rihanna, Representative McCormick, and members of this committee for your consideration of my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Himshute.
Thank you. Was it Acela? No, Acela. Acela, thank you for your testimony. Through the chair, my question to you is, are health aides mandatory reporters?
Yes, they are, actually. Just like any other health professional, they have to follow the specific laws of the state in order to do that. But yes, they are.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Are there any additional questions or comments for Ms. Calhoun? No? All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Ms. Calhoun. And thank you again to everyone who was able to call in and share your thoughts on HB 78. We're going to take a brief at ease. All right, we are now back on the record. We will set this aside for the time being and have public testimony regarding HB 78 on Thursday. Thank you very much again, everyone who testified this morning and for the folks who joined us this morning to hear about HB 78. We'll now take another brief at ease to transition to our next presenters. Brief at ease. We are now back on the record. I would like to first thank Representative Ortiz and Carolyn Hamm for your patience this morning. Thank you for sitting through half of our meeting. It's an hour. If you could now begin your introduction for House Bill 30.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. For the record, I am Representative Dan Ortiz. I represent District 1, which is Southern Southeast Alaska.
And I'm Carolyn Hamp, staff to Representative Ortiz.
Again, thank you, Chair McCormick, and members of the committee for hearing House Bill 30 today. If enacted, House Bill 30 establishes daylight savings time year-round. Daylight savings time is observed between the second Sunday of March, which we all just recently experienced, and the first Sunday of November, or the time we are currently in. For example, how this bill would work, we would spring forward one last time, just like we did last Sunday, and then never fall back. If we were to transition fully to daylight savings time, and the East Coast did not, we would only be 3 hours behind during winter months and would have the regular four-hour time difference during summer months. I'd also like to note that this legislature, almost a decade ago, heard a bill to keep us on standard time, not daylight savings time. This bill would also was also a time change bill, but that's where the similarities end. This bill would keep us on daylight savings time as opposed to standard time. There are many benefits, folks, to staying in daylight savings time. Your packet, apologize for its depth of lots of stuff there. They include four studies showing some of the benefits, which include increased physical activity, decrease in robberies, increase in economic spending, and a decrease in fatal car crashes. And the list goes on, but I won't keep going. There's also a study in your packet showing public support to stop changing clocks and overall preference for daylight savings time over standard time. Moving to full daylight savings time requires action by the United States Congress. Congress will need to amend federal law to allow states to observe daylight savings time all year. Or Congress could enact the Sunshine Protection Act, which would keep the entire United States on daylight savings time and would supersede HB 30. You might recall, some of you might have been aware that in the last federal legislative session, the Senate passed a daylight savings time bill. But then the House didn't take action, and now this is a new legislature, so I'm not sure what the direction is. I haven't heard too much about the issue here recently. Nationally, there is an initiative to change to full-time daylight savings time. So far, 19 states have enacted daylight savings time legislation, and an additional 21 states are considering legislation this year. On the West Coast, California voters authorized the change pending legislation, and both Oregon and Washington passed legislation in 2019, similar to the bill before you. Year-round daylight savings time is also gaining traction in Canada. Yukon began full-time daylight savings time on March 8, 2020. British Columbia passed legislation to implement year-round daylight savings time that is contingent on the United States West Coast also implementing it, like my bill. Because of our close economic and geographic ties to the U.S. and Canadian West Coast, Alaska can avoid We can all avoid it, folks, being left in the dark by passing HB 30. So it's up to our folks. We can, if the rest of the western states would move in direction and we got authorization from the U.S. Congress, and if we didn't pass this particular bill, then we would be, we'd be off from what our current situation is. And I'd just like to take a note, my bill does keep us on daylight savings time, which I realize creates probably some concern, particularly for the far western part of the state, being that they already, have a late sunrise, and this would even be a later sunrise if we didn't turn our clocks. Yeah, if we didn't move our clocks forward or turn them back in the fall. So in any case, there is that one issue, which I can see some of the part of the state having. But other than that, I've pretty much received support from places like Anchorage and Southeast Alaska, in that part of the state. I've received a lot of support. And generally, I'm sure you've all received some recent emails just because everybody kind of is aggravated by the fact that we had to, move our clocks forward and lost an hour of sleep. So it's kind of on people's mind right now. But anyway, thanks for the opportunity for presenting, and I'll be glad to answer your questions.
Thank you, Rep. Ortiz. Vice Chair McCabe, do you have a question?
Thanks. I have two questions, actually. One of the reasons that the Sunshine Protection Act in the lower 48 is worrisome to parents is the buses for children. And I suspect in Alaska you haven't heard much of that because probably most of the school year our children are on buses in the dark anyways.
Right.
I don't know. Have you got any pushback from that? And I'm also curious about these things that automatically change for daylight savings time. Is there reprogramming? Can we shut that off? Do you know anything about that?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, good question. I had that very thought for the first time this morning, as a matter of fact. What would happen with my clock if we made this change? How with my phone, if we made this change? I don't know the answer to that. We'll have to research that. I will research that and see what would happen with that. It's a good thought. I had that thought for the first time. For some reason, I hadn't thought about that, and I realized, hey, wait a minute. If we were to make this change, what would happen with these phones? But it's good.
If I could take a shot in the dark on that one, I would think that, no pun intended, but thank you for laughing. I would assume it would be connected. I think that's reset by internet connection or something like that, and so it might automatically do it that way. Just a thought.
Well, look, we will look into that particular question. Maybe it is an automatic situation, and I didn't fully answer your question. You asked whether or not we received any pushback from any parts of the state in relationship to the change in the amount of daylight, particularly when students are riding buses to school. And I would say that I haven't received any specific pushback on that. I think you're correct, Representative McCabe. Like in my community, we already go to school in the dark, or we come home in the dark. So, and in many, of course, a lot of the state is year round. Not year round, but in the wintertime, they go to school in the dark and they come home in the dark. I don't think there'd be that much of an impact in relationship to, well, there would be an impact. Like I said, in the western part of the state, the sun would rise that much later, and they would have that much more sunshine at the end of the day. Which they already have plenty at the end of the day, it sounds like. I think when I've thought about this bill, I can see that the biggest impact, perhaps negative, might be in the western part of the state. But again, my bill is not necessarily about a strong preference over standard time versus daylight savings time. It's more about in the event that the West Coast changes, we don't want to be off with the West Coast. It's just bad in a lot of ways. Creates confusion, creates lots of uncertainty and those kinds of things. And it's more about staying in line with the West Coast than it is about any particular preference over standard time versus daylight savings time. Although in my community, daylight savings time would work better. It would work better. So.
Follow-up, Vice Chair.
Follow-up. So I think Senator Marco Rubio and Representative Buchanan have introduced Rubio. Of course, it's the Sunshine Act, as you mentioned. Do you have, like, a companion resolution from the Alaska legislature? encouraging Congress to pass this? Something you considered maybe if we should move this bill out?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, good idea. You've come up with two this morning. You've come up with a good question and a good idea.
I can go home.
An extra hour of sleep.
That's a good thought. You know, we'll look into that particular possibility. And through the chair, Representative McCabe, maybe you could be the sponsor of that resolution, and I'll be happy to sign on to it. But we'll work together on that one. Anyway, good thought. Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. I hadn't realized really how much that all our time changes have changed so much in my lifetime. And this is something that has very much been in flux. I remember when we moved back the fall time, and all of a sudden my children were trick-or-treating when it was much lighter outside, and how I appreciated that. And now that my children are big, I will not quite realize the advantages, although the Anchorage School District does a pretty good job of timing spring break so that time change happens where the children have got a week to adjust. But I do, reading through the support letters or the testimony that there have previously been, I do think that there is some real consideration for Western Alaska. You know, as we were discussing, you know, earlier, Alaska is a very big state, and where we are now on the very eastern side of the state and where things are in Western Alaska, there's, you know, how many time zones we used to have. You know, it's a significant difference, and I really think that I support the idea of keeping the time the same, but really do think that we need to be thinking about standard time and consideration for Western Alaska. Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, has there been any consideration for, to Representative Mears's point, the Alaska has quite a span of returning back to some sort of split for Western Alaska if we were to stay on essentially one time? Or is that Alaska likes just being all on the same time? What are the thoughts on that?
Through the chair, this is Caroline Hampstaff, Representative Ortiz. Representative Ruffridge, we could state a preference, but ultimately it's up to federal decision. We obtained a legal memo in 2021 that I'm happy to share with the members about changing Alaska to multiple time zones again, and once again, it's up to federal decision.
Thank you.
Rep. Hemshoot, did I see you raise your hand? Okay, Vice Chair McCabe.
So I have one more question. In the 1970s, and I wasn't in Alaska then, the whole United States did this for 10 months because of the energy that was the initial oil crisis under Carter, I think, where oil went from 32 cents a gallon, or gas went from 32 cents a gallon. So remember when we dropped the speed limit to 55 countrywide? This was another part of it. I'm a little unclear if Alaska followed that, because at the time I think we had five time zones. So did we follow that with all five time zones? Did we follow it at all? You know?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, yes, I believe that Alaska did follow it at the time. And I do want to make a comment about that change, because daylight savings time wasn't always preferred at that time. I think there was a little bit of pushback. And we found that the pushback in the 70s came from the fact that many children at the time rode their bikes or walked to school, and it was a safety issue. And now, especially in the mornings, as we've discussed prior, with it being darker in the mornings, so we saw that a study that almost 50% of students walked or rode their bikes to school in 1969, whereas a similar study in 2009 showed that only 13% of students walked or rode their bikes to school nationally. That obviously might look different in Alaska. I know our transportation is a bit different, but that does show kind of why there was a little bit of a pushback when we did do that 10-month change.
Well, thanks.
Follow up? No?
I'm good.
So one question I did have,
If you can't answer that, that's fine. But could you speak to the original purpose of daylight savings and kind of dispel any of the misconceptions that it was to benefit farmers, please?
Through the chair, to the chair, this is Caroline Hamp. Originally, daylight savings was a measure to help with light and just being able to do your day-to-day tasks and have as much light as possible while you're doing that without burning your candles down or using electricity when you didn't have means to. It never was supported. The time change was never supported by farmers. I don't know where that rumor started, but most farmers are adamantly against time change. I grew up in the Midwest, actually. I did not grow up in Alaska. And for a long time, Indiana did not do time change because the farmers were so adamantly against it.
The follow-up question I might have to that then, is it true that energy consumption actually increases during daylight savings changes?
To the chair, this is Caroline again. I have a study that shows, and I can share this with the committee. There's a study that shows there's very, very little difference in either daylight or standard or whatever time you're in. There's very little difference in energy costs and energy consumption, just because in our modern day and age, we're just kind of always using energy, regardless of the light out.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from committee members? No. Okay. Well, and I've heard that you had no invited testimony. Okay. All right. In that case, thank you very much for presenting today. We will set this bill aside and probably have public testimony at a later date. So that's all we actually brief eddies. All right, we are now back on the record. Just for everyone's awareness, on Thursday, we will feel like we were pretty efficient today. So we'll test our efficiency Thursday because we'll be hearing three bills, HB 61, which is limitations on firearms restrictions, HB 17, contraceptives coverage, and a second hearing that is a public testimony for HB 78, the Alaska Community Health Aid Appreciation Day. The time is 9:22 a.m., and the hearing of the House Community and Regional Affairs is now adjourned. Happy Pi Day, everyone.